Hello, everybody, and welcome to the monthly CMDA meeting for today, November 1st. We're really glad to see you all. Before we start into our updates, I just wanted to say a big thank you to everyone who took the time to respond to the CMDA membership poll last month. We got a great response and feedback from people. We are going to act on the different ideas that came up. One of the general things is that we would like to keep the current schedule for the CMDA monthly meetings. So for the foreseeable future, we'll still have them on the first Tuesday of the month at 12 noon, just like we're having today. And there were a large number of people who would like to see some in-person meetings resume, and that does take time to coordinate in terms of space and food. So we'll look into that and make that a priority for the next year to look into some in-person meetings. But we're always going to have Zoom available for anyone to be able to join. So Jenny Albertson is our first presenter today, and I see that you've logged on, Jenny. Thank you so much for being here. Jenny is the Director of Quality and Regulatory Affairs for CHCA. Go ahead, Jenny.
Thank you so much. If it's possible for me to share my screen, I would love to do that.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I'm trying to find you on the list so I can give you that access. Oh, there you are. Okay, should be good to go.
Thank you. If you hear a little motor in the background, my puppy is snoring rather loudly, so I apologize for that. He is a lot bigger than a puppy should be. Okay. I'll try to zip through this quickly. I know you all have a very full agenda. Just wanted to give you a quick COVID regulatory update to make sure we're all on the same page from the provider side and from your support side. First of all, CMS did release a collective memo to eliminate a whole series of memos they've been releasing over the last couple of years. And the whole concept behind it was to aggregate information about surveyor expectations for vaccination. So vaccination requirements were in flux, as you know, I'm sure, with legal challenges across the US. So originally they had to separate guidance by state, and some of our states, like Colorado, took the bull by the horns and did their own vaccination mandate, thank goodness. And so at any rate, they've now assembled everything together so that surveyors know what game they're playing. So F888 is the tag that vaccination rules fall under. Generally speaking, if there's an issue with vaccination, it's going to be at a really low scope and severity, a C level, if you're familiar with the nomenclature for surveys. They're allowing facilities to show some discretion about how they mitigate potential of spread of infection from those that are not vaccinated. They're not rigidly describing that. And they're letting surveyors also use discretion as to when they focus on the issue of vaccination in a building, unless there's a complaint related to it. So it used to be that they had to go in on every single type of survey and look at vaccination. Now they have a window of time that they can, a 6-week window of time that they can skip that part entirely, and then they have the opportunity to just integrate it into the infection control section within a regular recertification survey. So that's an improvement in terms of scrutiny on our providers. So in terms of what's expected for vaccination, they do still want 100% vaccination of staff. That has not gone anywhere. This is for anybody who's CMS licensed. So if your building accepts Medicare, then you do have to have them comply with this. So 100% vaccination means fully vaccinated, primary series, plus exemptions or those who've been approved for a delay in vaccination. So staff incorporates pretty much the Heinz 57 that we've been accustomed to including from our Colorado reg. I described it there. It's anybody who's front-facing with a resident or has the potential to be. If people are less than 100%, but it's close and they have a plan for how to come to compliance, they're not going to engage in any enforcement action around that. But if they're at 50% vaccination and 50% unvaccinated or worse, there will be an increase in scope and severity. They'll come down on folks for that. So watch your percentages, because at this point, buildings have been hiring people that are unvaccinated because they saw this relaxing. And I'm getting the word out as best I can on this, but it's great to have your support on that as well. POC tests. This was a big hullabaloo that all of a sudden FDA approval for asymptomatic testing was yanked, and CMS pulled that through a memo, and then they very quickly rescinded their memo. So they decided to encapsulate it under the public health emergency. So for as long as that national public health emergency is in existence, they will allow us to use any POC test for any purpose, symptomatic or asymptomatic, and they won't penalize us for that. The special focus facilities changes that came out are really kind of scary. I'm not gonna be very detailed on this. I will send you the slides because they have the detail included, but just for the sake of time, they've changed the selection criteria to prioritize people who have or buildings who have lower staff to resident ratios. So if it's between two buildings, deciding who's gonna get that slot for a special focus facility, we only have one in Colorado at any given time, they will prefer the one who has staffing challenges. It's essentially heaping things on to a provider when they've been identified as a special focus facility. So achieving graduation from it includes now no survey with any deficiency volume greater than 12 tags. That includes life safety, that includes emergency preparedness, complaints, and then annual. And our average number of deficiencies in the state of Colorado, including those that are zero deficiency, of course, which skews the data, is usually between 6 and 8. But I think many of us have experienced the, 30 plus deficiency surveys, which are just oh so fun, usually with a federal oversight. So often when someone is already down on their luck in terms of being a special facility, special focus facility, they will have a particular challenge meeting this graduation threshold. And IJ will put them right back at the beginning as far as being a special focus facility. And they've increased the stakes, which means they have made it up to and including decertification for people that cannot reach compliance within the couple of years that they are on a special focus. And they also have said that they will continue to monitor buildings that graduate for 3 years. And if they slip up, they can put them right back on, or they can immediately impose the same kinds of penalties that they would if they were a special focus facility. The following slides go into great detail on all of this, as well as how special focus facilities are selected. You will have this in your slides, but I'm not going to take up all the time here to do that. Quick reminder, enhanced barrier precautions are a thing. If you have not dug into this with your QAPI team at your building, please do so. Starting with auditing, who meets the criteria, which is only the two elements, right? Wounds or indwelling medical devices or infection or colonization with an MDRO. They're not expecting us to broad-based test. They're not expecting us to go back and dig in people's records to see what their MDRO status is. They just want us to go off that basic criteria. And then we really need to train our teams, because a lot of people have this perception that they are in need of PPE upon entry to an enhanced barrier precaution room, no matter what. That is not the requirement. And the infectious disease crew at CDPHE has been very emphatic about this. They don't expect this to be a massive hullabaloo like we feel like it is. And the reason is that they really do think that high contact daily caregiving only includes these elements. And they think that those things are not so frequent that it should be burdensome. That's going to really vary based upon which resident we're talking about, right? Some people are going to need to be transferred and provided with hygiene very, very frequently. All of those instances will require PPE, but it is not upon entry to the room, if you would please clarify that with your team. And CDC has made some really great tools available. There's a letter to families template, a letter to nursing home staff template, a one-page summary table, which tells you how to utilize and how to determine what type of enhanced barrier precaution to utilize. And then there's a sign for both English and Spanish that kind of alerts people at the front door. So feel free to go to that website. Again, this will be in your slides. Wanted to also alert you, speaking of the infectious disease team at CDPHE, we are collectively on a group that shares information with Colorado Hospital Association. The Healthcare Associated Infections team at CDPHE heads it up, and Leading Age is often part of it. It's just a really great collaboration. And one of the things that we want to tackle is antibiotic stewardship, kind of looking at it from a fresh angle, from the prescribing angle, and it, trying to track it back to hospitals. So we've come up with some brainstorming around ways that we can put out one very focused collective initiative at a time, not this kind of, here's all of our targets and here's all the ways that you can meet them. No, we want to be very, very focused and send a unified message. I'll be keeping you all in the loop if you're not on the meeting, perchance, so that you know exactly what messaging we're going to be sending out to our members and to your partner providers. And then also look for this coming down the pike in January. We've had a lot of people request particular training for those who are behaviorally challenged, mental health challenged in our communities. And of course, the sources for those things range from chronic homelessness, substance abuse, cognitive impairment like TBIs, things other than dementia, and then mental health challenges and lack of support, which we know we're not going to remedy anytime soon in this state. So we do have a training in the works that we're trying to parse into components so that it can be recorded, both interactive initially, but also then recorded in parts so that you all can use this as front-facing webinar-based training for 15, 20 minutes for an all staff, or specifically focused on a particular type of resident need that you identify in QAPI. So I want you to know that we're working on some tools in that area because it has been severely lacking as far as education across the state. There's a question in the chat about special focus facilities being flagged in Nursing Home Compare. If they are a special focus facility, they flag them differently in Nursing Home Compare. And there's, like I said, only one in Colorado at any given time. The five or so that CMS recommend as candidates for potential special focus facility status will not be, they'll not be publicized on Nursing Home Compare. That is between the state survey agency and CMS. So it's only the one that is flagged. And then in case you missed it, over-the-counter hearing aids are available now for Medicare coverage. Just wanted you to know that. It can be rather costly to go through the entire audiology experience, which oftentimes for our elders is necessary, but for those that can get an over-the-counter, it is available and covered now. And then here's our upcoming events. Again, this will be in the slides, and it's always on our events page on our website as well. Some pretty exciting stuff in terms of support for people as caregivers. December 8th, there will be a special training on that particular issue. And then if you're interested in the regulatory updates, there will be a full day training coming up on December 1st. It's going to be our first attempt at trying to do hybrid. We're getting some new camera work in place, and we'll just see how that goes. But we're seeing hybrid as our way of the future because we want to incorporate all of our members across the state as you all are trying to do as well. And that's it. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jenny. We always appreciate your education and the upcoming education you have too. And thanks for taking that question in the chat box. I'm assuming it's okay to share your slides as always. Yep. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. I'll get them right over to you.
Okay. Appreciate it. And I think we have a couple minutes for updates from the CDPHE. I understand that Chad is off today. I see Joe Tanzi on though. Yep, Joe, would you like to?
Sure. Chad's on vacation this week. Okay. So, and just to piggyback on what Jenny said a little bit about special focus facilities, there are some additional enforcement activities that we can implement as well. If someone is chosen to be special focused, we can do and are encouraged to do a directed plan of correction to help get them back into compliance, as well as we can require a consultant for if there's a particular area that they need assistance in. Also, temporary management we can recommend, and CMS will put that in their enforcement for someone, so to get off special focus. And those are just really to help folks get off special focus so because we've had some, in the past, we've had some facilities have been on special focus, a special focus facility for 3 or 4 years. CMS says that's no longer acceptable. And we need to get people graduated or they need to be decertified. So that's, we're all have heightened awareness of this. So we want to help as much as we can for people to get to graduate from special focus. So, and we use 3 years history in helping us decide. We don't just look at current. We also go back 3 years to see what their survey history was. And then we do look at their staffing information to help make that determination as well. As staffing can be related to quality of care. So those are the things that we look at. We do let the facility know that they have been chosen for special focus. So it's not just a complete surprise when they get the letter from CMS. So we try to do that. I also wanted to, with the enhanced barrier precautions that Jenny mentioned, we do not survey to those. So we are not expecting to see those practices when we're out surveying. But if your policy says that that's what part of your infection control program is, then we would survey that to those because that's what you say you're going to be doing. Or if just in an interview, if you say that's what you're using, then we would survey to them. But otherwise, we're not going to be looking for the use of enhanced barrier precautions. Wanted to also just mention the dementia partnership and the reduction of psychotropic meds. CMS has set that as an area of focus for us. So, you know, during the pandemic, the use of psychotropic meds increased in Colorado as it did in many other states. And so we've all been challenged with trying to get those down. So we will be looking at those more, more in depth and probably we'll see more citations because of that. So wanted to just bring those things up, but I, you know, and just with the changes in the regulations that went into effect on the 24th, make sure if you're using arbitration, make sure that's in, you have that written somewhere, what your policy is, who's doing it, have a list of residents that that have assigned an agreement for that, because those are some of the things we'll be asking for when we're out there on survey. But I think that's all. Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks, Joe. Thanks for clarifying some of where the CDPHE intersects with those issues. If there are other questions, either for Joe or for Jenny, please put them in the chat box. Thank you so much. Our next speaker is from California. She is the president of the California Association of Long-Term Care Medicine. We're very pleased to have Dr. Janice Hoffman-Simon, PharmD, EDD, associate professor at Western University of Health Sciences College of Pharmacy. She will present on emotional intelligence and communication for healthcare professionals practicing in long-term care. Welcome to Dr. Hoffman. Janice, I forgot, am I sharing this? Oh, you're sharing them. Thank you so much.
I'm sharing it.
Yep, you take it away. Thank you.
So we're going to be talking about emotional intelligence. And the good thing about emotional intelligence is it can be learned. And it's very important to building your team that's going to help you. I have no disclosures here. We're going to talk about Goleman's 4 domains of emotional intelligence, and we're going to talk about how the individual emotional intelligence and team emotional intelligence work. And then we're going to talk a little bit about nonverbal and verbal communication if we have time to talk about it. I also have book covers to kind of show you some of the references you can use to build your own emotional intelligence. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is, oops, I'm sorry, it went forward. is what the definition. So basically, Daniel Goleman and a bunch of other social sciences came together and decided that the best way to describe emotional intelligence is being able to recognize your own feelings and those of others in order to motivate ourselves and manage our own emotions, as well as recognizing them in others and in our own relationships. So it's about managing relationships as well as as well as managing your own emotions. And we also, if the research on emotional intelligence shows that emotional intelligence, the better emotional intelligence you have, predicts success. And it also helps with the ability to acquire new competencies. The better emotional intelligence improves that. And we also decided that there's also literature that shows that emotional intelligence is more important than IQ, and we'll talk a little bit about that. So why is emotional intelligence so important? Well, it's seen as a fundamental key to success and feeling satisfied with your goal. It's not being nice. It's not about being nice. It's about managing your own emotions and being able to handle those of others, working together and being able to lead others and motivating them towards a common goal. The nice thing, as I said before, is that emotional intelligence can be learned. And I'm going to share some books with you that will help with that if that's something you're interested in. So really, it's about, and all leadership activities are about learning more about yourself. And the more you learn about yourself, the more you learn about being able to help others, as well as being understanding yourself and how you might react to something. And what we see in emotional intelligence is those that have really good interactions with others probably have that little something that helps navigate interactions. And if you have better emotional intelligence, you have better social interactions, professional interactions, and it also helps with relationships at home. It's being able to show empathy. And a lot of you will say, oh, I'm empathetic. That's not an issue. But are you empathetic to where the other person feels it? And are you able to express your own feelings appropriately such that it doesn't affect other people? I always use the example of a psychiatrist who walked into an interdisciplinary team meeting and dropped his coffee cup. Of course, four-letter words came out, and he was very demanding about getting housekeeping to clean it up. Instead of we all handed napkins and put it on the floor. And, we all started trying to help clean it up. And he was like, don't do that. Housekeeping can do it. And it was his whole not realizing how he was reacting to the situation that was making everybody on edge in the team. So that's always the one that I use to show that it's a low emotional intelligence. So when we look here, these are the competency model for emotional intelligence. You have two competencies in looking at yourself, and then there's two that look at how do you manage with others. So when we look at ourselves first, it's recognizing our own emotions and being able to assess that and having that self-confidence that you have control over your emotions, that you're able to be transparent. You're able to say, I'm really frustrated because of this that's happening in the facility. You're able to adapt. You have that achievement drive that you want to achieve, that you can initiate things. So these are all regulated things that you need to self-manage and regulate versus when we're looking at other people. What's our orientation? Are we service oriented? Are we aware of what the organization looks like? Do we have empathy for CNAs, or like I said, the psychiatrist who really didn't think about how the housekeeping me a felt, coming in to clean and when a meeting going on. And then I think about probably, I believe the hardest thing is relationship management. And the reason I believe that is we have to be able to inspire others, but also be able to influence and manage conflict. And I think managing conflict is one of the hardest things to do. And there's a lot of techniques to do it, but I think it's being, listening to both sides, being that catalyst to change the situation, influencing both sides to work together towards that common goal, and building those bonds that last. So when you need help down the road, that people are there willing to help you because you built that bridge, you built that bond with them. So here's another way to look at this, personal confidence versus competence versus social competence, being able to recognize your strengths and weaknesses, being able to call on others to who might have strengths where your weaknesses are. You can do all kinds of different tests to see what your strengths are. I like strength finders. Leading from where you are is very important. I think in self-regulation and managing emotions, that building trust and responsibility and adaptability is probably one of the things. Trustworthiness is probably the biggest thing, because if your team has trust that you're going to follow through and do what you say you're going to do, and you have the responsibility showing them you're going to do it, then you have their support. And if you're able to communicate that and be able to build their cooperation, you do have that little something, that emotional intelligence. So why is this so important? Well, job success is not just about survival, it's about growth. And growth is when you're uncomfortable and building more business or building more income runs very parallel to emotional intelligence. And just because you work hard doesn't promise you job security. You can work very hard and you can get laid off, or they have a contract with someone else because maybe you didn't fit in or you weren't able to read the body language of others. And what we hear a lot from employers, now most of you are probably contract, but what we hear mostly is about social skills and wanting to continue to learn. Some of us get to an age where we just don't want to learn anymore. And we all need to be lifelong learners to keep going with our careers and keep growing. And if you can't take criticism, don't deal it out. We all need to be able to make ourselves the best we can be. So we need to take that criticism to heart and figure out, okay, maybe in this situation, I didn't act appropriately. What could I have done better? And what we find is those who are not able to have social skills or motivated to learn or can't take criticism, it leads to plateaus in their careers and there becomes gaps in their ability to move forward. And what we see is the more complex the job, the more emotional intelligence matters. So what we see is that IQ is just the tip of the iceberg, but EQ is the whole underneath and supportive of that IQ. And IQ alone will not cause success and you to feel good about your career. Now, there's a brand new book that came out by Bradbury and Graves. It's called Team Leadership 2.0. And it's basically talking about not just individual EQ, but the whole team. Is the team aware of emotional awareness? Do they recognize what triggers others? Do they understand the reaction? Is the team satisfied with each other? Do they feel respected and belonging to the team? Those are all things that lead to increased productivity. And we look at how we feel, how team members behave in response to their emotions will affect the ability for the team to work well towards common goals and be able to mobilize the, when we have good feelings about a team and we feel like we belong and respected, it tends to stimulate peak team performance. The other thing is, the other side of team emotional intelligence is connections. So do we feel connected? Are we bonded? Again, these were things in relationship management and individual emotional intelligence. So it's being able to have that strengthening of those team relationships. Healthy and fun bonds leads to productivity and the ability to support the group through even challenging times. The teams that were had really high emotional intelligence had did very well during the pandemic because they were able to help each other through these difficult times. Those are internal relationships. What about the relationships outside of your organization? So outside of a facility, what about those? When we talk about team connectivity, we also talk about expanding the sphere of influences outside of that internal team. And it's helping to find resources to support the internal and external team and finding solutions to some of the problems. We need to redefine and expand, not the I set. Can you let him out? Thank you. Not to expand the I mindset, but the we mindset. There's no I in team. It's about we. We work together to make things happen. And it's more about giving than taking. So it's more about giving to others and making the team strong than it is taking from others. And so that's team emotional intelligence. Some of the things that you'll see is the team's performance will benefit from, as a leader, when you work on your individual emotional intelligence. So if you improve your self-awareness, that helps to identify changes in the team. Moods, both negative and positive, can affect the team. Self-management, your bad mood, like I said about the psychiatrist who dropped the cup of coffee, it shouldn't worry the team about how you're going to interact with them. And improved self-awareness helps you to know when and how to speak up within the team meeting. So that's a really important one, to not talk under your breath and to speak up when the time is right. Relationship management, I think the number one thing from learning about EQ is learning how to resolve conflict between team members. And the one thing I've always remembered about leadership is always negotiating the win-win. There's always a compromise that both sides will feel that they're, that it's a win-win. So here are the six. I'm not going to go through this with a lot of time, but just realize that the six signs of an emotionally intelligent team have to deal with redefining norms, making sure the norms fit the team, you asking a lot of questions to strengthen relationships, and that includes buy-in. And making sure that it's okay for anyone to say, I feel this way. Psychological safety is important in building trust. And the more trust in a team and relationships, the better performance you're going to get. And also balancing relationships with tasks, prioritizing team learning, and then how to listen to each other. So what are the personal benefits of emotional intelligence? Well, you will feel like you're more successful in your career because you will be more satisfied with your career. It strengthens personal relationships outside of work and professional relationships. You will find as you increase your emotional intelligence, you will increase your optimism. You'll be happier and more confident. And your physical health will be better because your mental health is doing better. What we see for professional benefits is you will become a better leader. I think the biggest effect of emotional intelligence for me has been being able to more directly communicate what I want done amongst the team, what I need from them, and what they need from me. And so I'm not having the conflicts I used to have at work, and I've become better at problem solving because I understand what's important to the members of different teams that I work with. And also I'm looking, a promotion is always an option. And sometimes we want it, sometimes we don't, but at least it's an option there for us. So this is a great chart just to look at how low emotional intelligence is viewed by others versus high emotional intelligence. So when someone has low emotional intelligence, they're looked at aggressive, demanding, egotistical, bossy, confrontational. So those are all really negative, but if they have good, high emotional intelligence, they're more ambitious, they're strong-willed, they're decisive, and they're assertive rather than aggressive. And we all want to be viewed like that. We have people who are selfish and poor listeners versus people who are charming and persuasive. Again, it's how you present it. It's not necessarily what you say, but how you say it. So we're gonna watch a video. So let me stop sharing and pull up the other screen. And I want you to think when we watch this video, I want you to think about the emotional intelligence of both the attorney and this is Eric Brockovich.
All right. Thanks so much. Bye.
Oh, what's up?
Yeah, I have your bonus check.
Okay.
And now I want you to be prepared. It's not exactly what we discussed.
Why not?
As after careful consideration, I felt that figure was not appropriate. Although you may not agree, you have to trust my experience and
trust.
Judgment.
You want me to trust you? Do me a favor, Ed. Don't use big words you don't understand.
It's a complicated issue, Baron. You know,
I did a job. You should reward me accordingly. It's not complicated. You know what? That is the fucking problem. All you lawyers do is complicate situations that aren't complicated. Do you know why people think all lawyers are backstabbing, blood-sucking scumbags? Because they are. And you know, I cannot believe that you were doing this to me now when I'm up to my ass in Kettleman plaintiffs, which, by the way, looks like it's going to be double the amount that we had in Hinckley. And you expect me to go out there, leave my kids to be looked after by strangers, knock on doors, get these people to trust you with their lives, and the whole time you're screwing me. I want you to know something, Ed. It is not about the number. It is about the way my work is valued in this firm. It's about how no matter what I do, you're not.
As I was saying, I decided that the figure you proposed was inappropriate. So I increased it. Do they teach beauty queens how to apologize? Because you suck at it.
Okay. I have to turn this off somehow. Okay, see if I stop sharing now. So just want to get some...
Let's be honest here. Yeah. $20 million is more money than these people have ever dreamed of.
Yeah.
Oh, see, now that pisses me off.
Sounds like the video is still going, Janice, in the background.
Let's be honest. We all know there are more out there. They may not be the most sophisticated people, but they do know how to divide. And $20 million isn't shit when you split it between them.
Yeah,
second of all, these people don't dream about being rich. They dream about being able to watch their kids swim in a pool without worrying that they'll have to have a hysterectomy at the age of 20, like Rosa Diaz.
Okay. Sorry about that.
Thank you. Oh, this is really great stuff, Janice. I'm thinking so much just with every slide. Just want to remind you, you have about 3 minutes left.
Okay, so let me go back to the slide set.
Yeah, thanks.
Hang on. I lost the slide, so hang on. There we go. So when you look at that video, and we're gonna talk a little bit about this now. So what can you do about your own emotional intelligence? If you wanna test your emotional intelligence, there's this book, it's called Emotional Intelligence 2.0. I really like it. It's been out for a long time. It's hardback is about $20 and it gives you a code to go online. There's also, he came out with an emotional intelligence for, oops, I don't know why it's not picking up. There it is. Emotional intelligence for what it means and what it means. There's Team IQ. There's a quick employee activities that you can do just to build emotional intelligence. So there's a lot of things. I have no interest in any of these products. You can do the test alone and figure out what you want to work on. There's a lot of resources online, but this is all developing yourself and making yourself better. Now I want you to think about that, the attorney. His body language, his facial expression, he smirked a couple of times because she was getting upset without realizing that the amount of money was much more. The other thing, his movements and his space that he took can tell you a lot, and his gestures, but he didn't really gesture a lot. So it was hard to tell, but his posture was very relaxed. So he knew she was gonna be happy. She didn't read his cues. And so her emotional intelligence was hampered by her reactivity to the words. And so that looking at the nonverbal versus the verbal, it's not just what you say, but it's how you say it. It's your nonverbal. It's using I statements whenever possible. When you deal with learners who have difficulty listening, you want to make short, quick sentences rather than longer ones. And probably the most important thing in a communication is being a listener. You can paraphrase what someone says if it seems unclear. You want to make sure that you understand what they really want to know, because you should only answer what they really want to know. It's not about giving opinion about what the speaker says, but being able to answer in a response. And what a lot of us do is we think about what we're going to say while someone else is talking, and therefore we're not really listening. So just in summary, IQ, emotional intelligence skills are highly dependent on yourself and those around us. And it's more about when we interact with others, being more empathetic. It's a learned skill. It can really decrease in times of stress, and you can really work through it and make it more valuable. And then middle managers have the most emotional intelligence. They have the best. Why? Because they have to work with the upper people and the lower people. So you can always watch those people, because you can really learn a lot from them. There is some generational divide because of life experiences, and communication is key to building trust. Nonverbal, verbal, and listening skills are all really important. And I think I did it. And here's some of the references.
This is amazing. Thank you so much, Janice. You're already welcome. Had requests for a copy of these slides, so I look forward to sending them out. And great. I think that, yeah, just so much practical and wisdom here for us to use in our professional lives. Thank you very much for doing that presentation. I'm sure there are questions. We'll take them in the chat box. And at this time, I'd like to, thank you very much. At this time, I'd like to go ahead and introduce our next speaker, who is Leah McMahon. She is the Colorado State Long-Term Care Ombudsman. And prior to her current position, Leah was a local long-term care ombudsman with Denver Regional Council of Governments. And she has 12 years of ombudsman experience. She has a bachelor's degree in sociology from Regis University and master's degree in sociology from Northern Arizona University. Thank you to Leah for being here today. And I'll let you go ahead and present your slides too.
Okay, great. Thanks, Singh. And thank you, Dr. Hoffman, for that wonderful presentation on emotional intelligence. That's one of my favorite topics. And I have my book right here. I really enjoy that. And there's nothing more than I enjoy than talking about the Ombudsman Program. So thank you for allowing me time today to provide a brief overview of the program. So let's see if I can get this started. Here we go. All right. So most of you are aware the Ombudsman Program has been around for about 50 years. And it has been established in every state in the United States. Every state has a state long-term care ombudsman that acts as the head of the program or the director of the program, so to speak. Here in Colorado, our model is a decentralized model, meaning that the local ombudsmen have their own local ombudsman entity, a host agency within the Area Agency on Aging, and they provide the personnel oversight, and I provide the programmatic oversight and supervision. So primarily, the ombudsmen, which are representatives of the state office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program, are resident directed advocates. And what this means is that we take our direction first and foremost from the residents. We have to see them and talk with them and ask about their concerns. So if someone called in, such as a family member or a professional or a staff person within a licensed assisted living home or nursing home, we would inform that person that we need to go out and meet with the resident first to find out what the resident wants us to do and if this is actually, you know, a concern of theirs. And so then we get permission from them and then we can proceed. Our mission is to advocate for quality of life and quality of care and improve the quality of life and care for residents. The Ombudsman Program is authorized through the Older Americans Act. That's where we have our authority. We primarily investigate and resolve complaints. We provide information to residents and families. And my job is to advocate for systemic changes to improve residents' care and quality of life by, you know, looking at legislation, monitoring bills that are coming through, and then looking at our statewide data and setting priorities around that, as that is the voice of the residents. They're telling us through that data what year-round are the issues and the concerns. So here in Colorado, we have 16 regions, and the state office is oversees those local programs. So there's myself, the state long-term care ombudsman. I have a deputy state long-term care ombudsman, Sari Kimura, who handles internal operations. And then we have a quality assurance program manager that looks at our data, helps me with the federal report and fiscal management. In addition to that, Colorado has a state-based ombudsman, and I was in that position when the program was created and the Senate bill was passed in 2016. So now our reach is also for people who are enrolled in the PACE programs across Colorado. So we get to advocate for them as well. Right. And so here you can see through this map all the different areas where we have ombudsmen. So you look on the eastern side here and, you know, folks have to travel quite a ways. Sometimes there's a lot of windshield time for the ombudsman in the rural areas. Just to get to one facility sometimes can, you know, take a whole day to get there to work and then return home. But every place that there is a licensed assisted living home or nursing home, the ombudsman have access to the residents and the residents have access to us. So I guess, you know, what people oftentimes wonder is, What is it like in the day in a life of an ombudsman? What does it look like when you come to visit a licensed nursing home or assisted living home? Visibility is everything to this program. And that's because we want to make sure that the residents know who we are, why we're there, that we don't work for the facility, but that we work for them, but that we work with the facility with their permission to help resolve concerns. We do this at the lowest level possible. We are not regulators. We are not enforcers. We are low-level problem solvers to resolve concerns to the satisfaction of the resident as much as possible. And as you can imagine, that's not 100% all the time, but we try our best. So we may come in and, knock on doors. If it's a larger assisted living home or nursing home, we may visit residents that maybe are in the dining room or hanging out in the common areas. Things have changed quite a bit, as it has for us, in how that looks pre-pandemic till now. Just like everybody else, we had to pivot and do things a little bit differently. But a lot of our job too is not just introducing ourselves and talking about the program, but it's also about education and information. We first want to empower residents to see what have they done, who have they spoken with, and what parts of their concern do they want to resolve, and then what parts do they want us to resolve. Sometimes residents may just tell us, I want you to do the whole thing. Even with that, we're still going to go back to the resident and say, here's what we've done so far. Here are suggestions of what else we can do. How would you like me to proceed? So we really do take their direction. And we serve anyone who is in a licensed assisted living home or nursing home in the state of Colorado. And that includes all populations and ages of folks that live in these communities. Years ago, when I first became an ombudsman, we did have an age requirement, and that's changed. The Older Americans Act was updated to reflect that change. And so I think I've already covered these points here. Again, we can only take action if the resident gives us consent to do so. If a resident has an identified representative that they've chosen and they are no longer able to make their own decisions, we will look to that person that they identified to obtain consent. So I put together, because Singh wanted me to talk a little bit about what's the main thing, you think, that I can share with you today that I want you to know that I thought would be helpful also for the work that you do. This is really the voice of the residents, but these are the top six complaints that we received from federal fiscal year 21. And it hasn't changed that much this year as we're starting to look at our data. But the main concerns that family members, residents, and other community members have brought as complaints or concerns to the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program here in Colorado are quality of care and quality of life issues, which is, mostly around the care that is provided or the quality of care that's provided within assisted living homes and nursing homes here in Colorado. Honoring autonomy, choice, and preferences is another concern that has been brought to the program. Transfers and discharges and admission, as y'all could imagine, the pandemic has created definitely some challenges around that for residents. Environmental issues are things like cleanliness. It could be that maybe someone's room was not tended to in a timely manner to be cleaned, or the trash wasn't emptied. I know that some folks called about concerns regarding just safety precautions around COVID. And then dietary, just lack of choice in food, or the temperature in the food was not so great. As we've all known, the challenges around staffing shortages and some trouble there. So that really impacts all of these areas that we're seeing on the screen right now. And then six was abuse and neglect. And the main thing I would like to highlight here is that for the first time nationally in federal fiscal year 21, the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program as a whole, as you look across the United States, abuse and neglect was number five, as we reported all of our data and the National Ombudsman looked at our data as a whole. So that is, you know, of huge concern for all of us. And I just wanted to highlight for here in Colorado, it was number six. So it wasn't within the five, but it was number six. And so we have some very special projects that we're working on to provide education and information around abuse prevention and awareness. And I like how Dr. Hoffman talked about the emotional intelligence piece, because I find that that can be just a huge impact to preventing abuse and neglect, is to have that emotional intelligence, to be well regulated, to interact with, you know, people with emotional intelligence. And having those interpersonal skills, I think, are key to understanding one another and helping, you know, prevent those kinds of things when we can control ourselves and we can think about what we're doing. And so some of the ways that you can work with your ombudsman is we provide a lot of education and training around resident rights. That's definitely our wheelhouse. That's one of the main things that we do. We attend resident council and family council. We also help create those when and where we can, and can work with the different communities in assisted living and nursing homes to help establish that. Education. We all have our own niche and background as ombudsmen in what maybe different expertise areas of expertise we have. And we're also happy to talk about those things as well, including trainings on abuse and neglect and how to prevent that. And then we also can help with individual and systemic advocacy. One of the main things that I think that assisted living homes and nursing homes will call us for is when there are family issues. You, as providers, recognize when resident rights are being violated, and you call upon us to step in and maybe help educate that family member that may not have an understanding of all those resident rights. And that is all I have. Here is my contact information. I can also send this out to Sing and in an email, and she can get that out to y'all. But I am a standing member of this meeting, so I know I can't always make it. I have another national meeting that conflicts with this meeting, so I try to change based off of the topics that are happening at the national level. But I'm happy to be a part of this group, and I look forward to continuing to being a part of it. Thank you. Does anybody have any questions?
Sure. Appreciate that overview, Leah. Your work is so important, and we appreciate you being part of CMDA. I'd love to send your slides out. We have a couple minutes left, and we had asked AMDA for some update on opportunities through the AMDA Foundation. And who better to present that than the executive director for AMDA, Chris Laxton? Thank you, Chris, for being here today, too.
Sure thing. Thank you, Singh. I very much appreciate the invitation. And hello to all of you CMDA members. It's great to be with you. I'm going to just take a couple of minutes, if I could share my screen.
Oh.
To talk a bit about the foundation.
Appreciate it.
I know I only have a minute, so I'll be really quick.
Sorry about Chris, that.
That's cool. Perfectly okay. So yeah, if I had more time, I would brag about the foundation. I'm so proud of what we've been able to achieve with all of the support of our chapters and individual donors. But given the time available to me, I'm just going to jump straight to a couple of things that I know are important to you. Firstly, our Futures program is clearly our flagship. It's our Gold Star program. And we have always funded, through the help of our chapters, some 60 to 70 clinicians to come to our annual conference. Colorado has always been there with us. It's been both a founding member as well as a longtime supporter, and I'd say a beneficiary. Here's some familiar faces that you all know. Carrie Levy, of course, is a Futures scholar, but she also ran the Futures program for many years before becoming AMDA president. So Futures leads to leadership, and in the case of Carrie and others, many of our AMDA presidents have been graduates of the Futures program. Our most recent graduate, Dr. Mira Melton, also from Colorado, is another person who's benefited from it. One thing I will say, the foundation has really evolved. And for the first time this year, we've actually started funding research. We awarded our first research grant to Dr. Brian McGarry to study the impact of indoor air quality in nursing homes. That is because we have had the support of all of you. Now, this Friday is an important day, and I wanted to just touch on it because our national awards deadline for nominations are coming due. So we've got the Dodd Award for Distinguished Service. That's our kind of lifetime achievement award. The Petit Award for Education for Distinguished Service in the field of professional development. And then the Medical Director of the Year and the new award, the Clinician of the Year, which started last year. So please think about colleagues, deserving colleagues, who you would like to see recognized in this way and submit the nomination to our foundation's website. Finally, I'll just say, always think about this as your foundation. We'd love to have your support either, and I know CMDA will support us, and I'm just, think about, how you would like to support the foundation as we go forward into our next iteration. We have a new director, Victoria Hahn, who unfortunately couldn't be here today, but this is her email address. And she'd love to hear from you. As you can see, there are many, many Colorado donors that have helped us over the years and continue to. So thank you, thank you, thank you. Finally, just Dr. Schweitzer's quote is one that's close to us here at the foundation. The example is not the main thing in influencing others, it's the only thing. It kind of fits in well with Janice's presentation on emotional intelligence, I think, doesn't it? Anyway, I'll leave you with this. Thank you, thank you. This is my granddaughter, Charlotte. She is she's dressed up for Halloween and is a pink and purple people monster. She lives in Portland, Oregon. And I just thought I'd give you a smile today with a picture of Charlotte. All right, thank you, Singh. I know I don't have much time. I just thought I'd touch briefly on some stuff.
Thanks for Charlotte, Chris.
Well, we appreciate that.
Yeah.
She's so cute. Thank you for sharing about the foundation, the deadline that's coming up. And I'll be happy to share the rest of the slides with our group, as well as feature the foundation at our annual conference. We've been talking about different ways to do that. So
terrific. I will send the slides to you, Singh.
Okay. We appreciate all of our speakers today and everyone joining in. Have a great week, everybody. The next CMDA meeting will be on Tuesday, December 6th.